Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our February Artist of the Month is Martin Newell, the founder of The Cleaners from Venus, a group who gained a cult following in the 1980s for their home-recorded and DIY-distributed cassettes, full of jangly, tuneful, and incisive songs about life in England after the swinging London bubble had burst. In the 90s, he began recording albums under his own name and became a prolific and renowned poet. More recently, he's brought back The Cleaners from Venus brand for a series of new albums, culminating with last year's superb Return to Bohemia. And Brooklyn-based label Captured Tracks have issued three immaculately packaged box sets of vintage Cleaners recordings. Martin spoke with Stereo Hysteria via telephone last month about his illustrious career, and we'll be hearing excerpts from that conversation throughout. But let's begin with the opening track from Return to Bohemia, called Cling to Me. Cling to me.
So good for you. Hung around for all this time. Did all I could for you. In the hope something might chime. Cling to me. Why don't you cling to me?
Questions will fire away, old boy.
First, congrats on the new album, Return to Bohemia. I think it's just as good as any of the stuff from the 80s.
Oh, that's what I was hoping. I really felt it was a return to form for me. And do you know why? Because I did everything myself, you know. I didn't ask anyone's opinion. I just got on with it, and I had my four-track. The good news, for people who are interested in the revival of the Cleaners brand, if you like, or at least my method of doing things like that, is that Captured Tracks in mid-April of this year will be bringing out on vinyl and on CD and for download a new double album of my work from the last 4 years, including half of Return to Bohemia,
okay,
half of English Electric, half of The Lake District, and half of another album, which I think we called The Stopping Train. And it was it's 24 songs of the absolute best, and I've written a lot of songs. I've written and recorded something like 50 or 60 songs, maybe more.
Wow.
in this past 10 years. And so we picked the absolute cream. This is not Broken Biscuits, and they're all done DIY style, you know, jangly guitars, strange noises, the whole, I mean, I haven't changed. I developed that style back in the 80s and I kind of liked it, so we I got a bit better at playing the instruments maybe over the years. I can't pretend to be a non-musician anymore.
What separates a Cleaners from Venus album from a solo Martin Newell album?
Well, this is a very strange thing. There are probably more different musicians on a Martin Newell album.
Okay.
Very often. I mean, the Cleaners from Venus did sort of start off as a band. There was me and Lowell and maybe another guy sometimes who'd help us out, Mac. Very briefly, he didn't make it to the first recordings, but he was there at the beginning. Well, I don't know if we had the name then. For a while, for about 5 minutes, we were called the Mistrons, and we found there was another band with that name.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, from the Cleaners from Venus, it was me and Lowell, and then it was me and Giles and various people helped me out. But as I say in the notes, it was my ship. I was the captain, you know.
Right.
We ran a pair of underpants up for a flag and, you know, hoped it would sail.
Here's the opening track from 1982's On Any Normal Monday, the second Cleaners from Venus album called Night Starvation.
Lost in my own home, walking in a dream, I can't remember where I've been. Nothing is the way it seems, I've got too much blood in my alcohol stream.
Andy Partridge.
Right, and I think that's the first collection of your songs that I ever heard, because I was a big XTC fan growing up.
Yeah, we did the album, we were starting on the album 22 years ago this week or
really?
Something like that. We started on the album, yeah. You know, when I first saw Andy Partridge being interviewed on television, I thought, there's a guy I'd get on with. Very funny man, nice guy.
Did you ever try to write together?
Andy and me, no. When we were making The Greatest of an Englishman, he said we really need another song, and I said, well, I've got this, and I played him the beginning of Straight to You, Boy. And he said, oh, well, look, I've got to mix some drums down. Go in the kitchen. He was in the shed, so I was in the kitchen. Got to finish that off. And that was the newest song. That was being finished off, the writing of it, even while we were making the album.
Mm.
But he didn't really contribute to it. But he does have a very different way of writing songs. For instance, Andy will write music to words, and I don't do that. I've done it once or twice just to see if I could do it, but it's not what I would naturally do. I let the tune drive the words.
Okay.
You know, Elton John, apparently, when he gets a load of lyrics from Bernie Taupin or something, he goes leafing through these things, and he's sitting there playing a piano, and he thinks, he apparently picks out lyrics and writes fits the tune around it, which is a kind of kooky way of working for me. And Andy can do that.
Right.
He can write a set of lyrics and write a tune to it. I don't know, I've just got... You develop your own way of doing stuff, really,
right.
Don't you? And I guess if you do it for long enough, it becomes your legitimate cottage industry thing.
And here's a song from The Greatest Living Englishman called The Jangling Man.
I am just a jangling man, been just a jangling man too long, long, long. The powers that be will bring.
made it, because I think no one was more surprised than Andy when he said, where would you like to make it? What, have you got a studio in mind? And I said, well, can't we do it in your shed? Because he's got this shed down the bottom of his garden. It's not a very big garden, but it's a slightly bigger than average shed. This is not a 6-foot by 4-foot thing you keep a lawnmower and two rakes in. It looks like a kind of Swedish municipal park shed, you know. He had very, very early digital technology then. It was an ADAT, 8-track. And they were in their very early days, because it was a hell of a good machine. It was a brilliant idea, but I think the ambitious technology of those some of those early models superseded the actual mechanical ability. So we got through something like 6 or 7 of them, and then Andy was in tears at one point. He ate the first version of the Green Gold Girl of the Summer.
Okay.
Just swallowed it digitally. We lost it. We had to build another one.
I guess that's the good part about using cassettes. They're more idiot-proof.
Using cassettes. I used to like using cassettes. Once I found a brand that I liked, I used a particular kind of Sony cassette. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't even the most expensive cassettes. They were Sony Chromes, I think I used, and they were utterly reliable. Mm. They were so strong. The mechanics were always good. And the tape was surprisingly durable, considering it went skittering backwards across those old TX 4-track studios. What I use now, you know, without doing any product placement, but credit where credit is due, 4 years ago, no less, I thought I need to learn this digital technology, so, because I didn't know it, I only, you know, my 30 years of recording experience was redundant. When I got more successful, they gave me engineers to work for machinery.
Sure.
That was my downfall, you know, with an engineer to work it, and I lost touch with it, so in the end I was going into studios not having a clue as to what the stuff actually was. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think that started with making the Greatest of an Englishman, because Andy already, he used something called Cubase.
Okay.
And that was pretty good. I just wanted a 4-track, and lo and behold, Tascam have come out with something called a pocket studio. There's a local radio station started around here, and they didn't have anyone to make their little adverts, so I said, look, I'll make you some adverts. And they said, well, you're going to have to get a digital thing, so I bought the cheapest one I could, and I saw the name Tascam, and I thought, Tascam 4-track? Well, that rings a bell. That's going to be good, and it's going to be simple, and I'm going to understand it. So I bought it. I've never looked back, and I haven't wanted to go up, because you start going up to the bigger machines, and they've got all these production choices, like echoes and things you can put in, and I thought, I just need a machinery that will record the signal, you know, record the guitar, record the piano, record the voice. Let me deal with the signal processing afterwards.
Right.
And I weld it up on a program called Audacity. So basically, this is about as DIY as digital gets, really. I'm kind of doing everything manually, but digitally. I don't want to save time. I want it to be done in a haphazard, amateurish, clumsy way. You know, it's like using a hammer to put a screw in, really. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm doing. I'm a primitive. If it can be done badly in a willfully amateurish way, I'm your man.
From 2011's English Electric, the first album under the Cleaners from Venus name in 21 years, here's a song called Wake Up and Dream.
Sorrows, wake up.
Reviews, the more critical reviews for the Bohemians said it sounds like demos, you know, some of them say they sound like demos, and I'm thinking, well, that's good, because all the time when I was growing up making records, my first records, I'd make this thing, and I'd think, this sounds really good, you know, then we'd get it in the studio, and then someone would put their bit in, and someone would put their bit in, and then they'd put some old fairy dust and gloss all over it, and you'd come back and you'd look at each other and you'd say, actually, I preferred the demo, except sometimes people never dared to say it because you just spent £2,000 on it or something.
Yeah.
So I hit this revolutionary idea one day. It became a sword in my hand. I just said, why don't we just release the demos? So that's what we did, and that's what I'm still doing. I've also got rid of the idea of using a drummer as well most of the time, because I can't find any who are stupid enough. You know, they're just not making stupid drummers anymore. Well, drummers, they're all doing university degrees and technical whiz kits and writing novels and things like that and attending art college and, you know, situationist symposiums. I don't know any stupid drummers. You know, it's a joke that drummers are somehow stupid. They're not. They're all really bright, super polymaths. I don't need that in a drummer. I need someone who can, you know, keep a beat and go boom, chick, boom, chick. Find me a drummer who'll do that.
A machine does it as well.
I don't even use a drum machine. They're too intelligent as well. What I've got is I've got a cheap guitar pedal, and it's got a choice of 30 drum beats on it.
Okay.
Four of them don't work. I don't know what happens to them. They just kind of go... I only ever use about, I don't know, somewhere between five or six beats. And then what I use the rest of the time is kitchen implements.
Okay.
I've got a tin full of yellow split peas. I've got one really good tambourine, and I've got a kind of broken old sizzle cymbal, which I stick on top of a hunting horn and jam in there with a broken chopstick, and then play it with two other chopsticks.
It doesn't get much more DIY than that.
That's where we started out, you know. To get a good bass drum sound, we used to wrap a cheap mic in a cushion and weight it down with a brick and stick it in the bass drum. We just sort of thought, well, that sounds pretty good. Why don't we just use that? But we... When we went in studios, I thought, listen to that bass drum, doesn't it sound luxurious? But I sort of thought, yeah, but, you know, when you hear it on the radio, it doesn't, does it?
Right.
You know, Tears for Fears, as opposed to spend something like 6 weeks recording a snare drum.
Right.
It all sounds great in the studio, and you've got 24 tracks, and you've spread your drum kit across 12 of it, and then you hear it on the radio, and what you've got is... and it don't really sound very big on a kitchen radio, so why make it big in the first place?
It's sort of like you dodged a bullet in the 80s, because your records from that time don't sound dated at all. There's not the big gated snare drum reverb and the Yamaha DX7.
That's right, yeah. Our trouble came, I noticed, when the Cleansing from Venus did... Well, we kind of got good and we got signed and we went into a big recording studios in London. And around about the second or third vinyl album, we had a keyboard player called Charles, a very good keyboard player, but he got given a Roland D50, which was a state-of-the-art thing at the time. And, you know, it would have been inhuman of me to refuse to let him use it, but, I mean, you can actually hear that now. You can hear some of the pads on that and say, yeah, September 1987, that's when everyone was using that sound. Probably even name the day in September. It'd be like September the 17th at about 3:30. That's when that sound was popular.
From 1988's Town and Country, one of two Cleaners albums recorded at Posh Studio and released in Germany on RCA Records, this is a song called Dizzy Girl.
She's a firework, she's a moving display. It's not fair on the moon to see her spinning.
Piano. I have got an electronic keyboard. It's a Yamaha DX27.
Okay.
And that's really good. It's got a very, very good organ sound on it, called a club organ. It's a very early analog sounding synth sounds. You know, real kind of early Kraftwerk and Chicory Tips type stuff. But when you get all these sounds, you can change the sound by doubling it, slowing one of them down, putting a big reverb on, and it's no longer the sound you had or even the sound you wanted. It's a completely different beast of its own. And I think, you know, Brian Wilson, the great Brian Wilson, he did this thing which I learned from listening to his stuff, where he's got, say, a saxophone and a piano and maybe a clarinet and a guitar, and you get them all to play the same phrase.
Right.
And so now it's no longer a clarinet, a guitar, a piano or a sax. It's a thing that you have no name for, but it sounds great. And he did that. And I think the Beatles did it. You hear it on stuff like Getting Better, you know.
Right, yeah.
I'm chiefly interested, though, in songs, in how songs are written.
Right. I think that your melodies and lyrics are always consistently interesting.
Yeah, I don't know how that happens. It's almost like someone else is writing them. It's really strange. I mean, I'll naturally go and do something different. I'm probably not quite as lateral, not quite as triangular as Andy Partridge. I think he taught himself to deliberately go off at a tangent with a melody, sometimes to the detriment of the melody. When the melody wants to go and do something sweet, he'll kind of go like that, and he goes up at an angle into space, you know, which is good, but it doesn't work all the time. What I will do is, where I'm working on a piece of music, you know, four or five chords that are going round and round, I'll suddenly make one of them veer off into, not the wrong key, but I'll put a seventh or a diminished or something, and suddenly something happens, and then that in turn leads you down to another alleyway, and you've got something different.
Do you remember the first time you tried writing songs?
Yeah, I do, actually. I was very young. It was the first thing I tried. I didn't ever think I'd be a good guitarist or anything like that, but I thought I might be a songwriter. So I was 14 years old, nearly 15. And I wrote a song, and it was not particularly good. I mean, I tried writing a song when I was 13, but I didn't quite know how you did it. I knew how you would fit it, but I couldn't think of what I would write it about. And by the time I was 14, something had happened, I don't know, and, you know, I was beginning to think, well, I'd written this kind of anti-war kind of apocalypse, sort of almost folky-sounding song in a kind of rolling minor, which was tragic, really. I thought, well, this isn't very good, and I never told anyone about it or played it to anyone. But round about that time, I wrote something that was much more raunchy and a bit like an early Who song or something like that.
Okay.
So I was listening to The Who a lot. And then I thought, well, this is getting nearer to it. I started writing songs at a rate of about 3 every 2 weeks. And I just kept on doing that for years, I did that. And I think I didn't really know what I'd got because kids in my school, I'd try and play these things in the school toilets and things, I was having a cigarette.
Mm.
And people would sort of wonder how I did it, but I couldn't. For me, it didn't seem that tough. I think I'd always had the idea of writing songs in my head even before I could play a musical instrument. It's a very, very strange thing. But sometimes nowadays I'll stop for a bit because I also write poems and features. Mm-hmm. If I stop writing songs for a few weeks, it's kind of like the well begins to fill up.
Okay.
Like I'm subconsciously doing, and I go back to it, and there are all these things, kind of ideas spill out of me. So I've got a kind of a little handheld recorder, and I just get a guitar or a piano and sing and play the rough ideas so I don't lose the rough ideas, which I used to all the time when I was younger.
Although I did hear an interview with Paul McCartney where he said, if you forgot the song back in the old days before tape recorders, then it probably wasn't good anyway.
Well, you know, Ralph Vaughan Williams, the English composer, said, only write the stuff that won't go away.
Mm.
And I do subscribe to that. But, it's, you know, when I hear a really good idea, or if ideas are absolutely pissing out of me, and I'm just thinking, let's just get it down anyway. We can go back and look at it, and if it's rubbish, we can erase it.
Right.
You know, it's usually just me humming a phrase over a chord sequence. But sometimes genuinely good stuff comes up, and I think, look, I cannot hold all this stuff in my head. I'm older now.
Coming up, we'll hear a song from 1987's Going to England called Julie Perfuma.
Someday soon I'll
On your blog, on your website, you recently wrote an entry about the end of 1967, about buying the Who sell out.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's because Disco Joe, off my forum, sent me this as a kind of unexpected pre-Christmas present. Mm. And it came roughly the same anniversary when I bought it anyway, because it came out on December the 16th, I found out.
The final sentence of that, at 14 years old, I was just a little too young and a little too late for the 60s. It seems like that's a theme that's in a lot of Cleaners from Venus songs, like Julie Profumo or Ilya Kuryakin Looked at Me, like being old enough to appreciate what's going on culturally, but too young to participate.
I kind of knew something was going on, but I didn't, you know, I wasn't grown up. But I think there are a few people felt like that, but I've just put it in words. It's something I've experienced since very young childhood, and even a nostalgia for that which has not yet happened. Mm. There's probably some fancy French name for it, but people in England don't tend to mess with philosophy too much. They regard it as unmanly. Yeah, but that's true. That's what I think. It does occupy me a lot. Also because I came from an army family and I spent the right middle wedge of the 60s in the Far East, as far away from England as you could get, nearly, okay, in Singapore. So you heard the records, but you didn't see the television programs. You didn't see it, for instance. I'm catching all this stuff on YouTube now. I saw a performance of It's the Byrds, you know, the American Byrds, not Ronnie Wood's old band. They come to England and they do, not Turn, 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 but one of the other ones, and not Mr. Tambourine Man, another one, and it's a really good song. And I'm watching this, and people in England would have seen this, but I wouldn't have seen it in Singapore, not in 1965. So basically I had the bottom end of 1964, all of 1965, and the front end of 1966, which is a long time when you're about 11, between 11 and 13. That's a long time to be out of the loop, because at that time, when the 60s hit its what it's called, its métier, whatever it was, when it hit its stride, brilliance was happening at every turn. I mean, you could turn on one of the pirate stations and just hear stuff that has since been decreed immortal pop was just coming out the whole time. And I was missing this. There were bits, you know, a whole chunk of the jigsaw missing forever from my youth. I'm stuck in blazing hot Singapore with a very unhip short back and sides haircut, in shorts and a short sleeved white shirt, as was dictated by the dress code of the British Army school I went to. So I got very dull and very dispiriting. In a way, it's good, it's fueled me, but you can't look backwards all the time, can you? But you can't look back at what wasn't there either, can you? So sure. I can only imagine it.
Up next, we'll hear another song from last year's Return to Bohemia called The King of the 60s.
She came in loud, she came on strong, and when she looked at you, it was a little bit too long. She took the sun for a lover and used the moon as her cover. And when the party was over, if she ever deigned to phone, she'd say the world isn't round till you're high above the ground. But you would know that thing when you have been the king. Say, I wasn't sure. I looked at her in a dream as I said, have we met before? She took a couple of pistols and blew the theory to crystals. The pieces fell on the landing and they lit the corridor. She said, the world isn't there until you've seen it from the air. But you would know that thing when you have been the king of the 60s. Bye.
Because of the age I am now, which is pretty old, I feel I'm entitled to do whatever I feel like when I get up in the morning, if there's the time to do it and it can be physically done. That's the music I'm doing, and I don't really care what anyone thinks. I don't try and keep up with the trends in music. I didn't do in the first place. A whole chunk of the 80s just kind of passed me by. I saw New Romantics, for instance. Do you remember? You won't remember them, but you'll probably know what they are. You know, and I just saw these guys on television and thought, what in the name of frigging some frig is that? You know, it's, you know, there's a guy, I don't know whether to swear on your blog, so I'm trying not to.
Oh, go for it.
There's a guy, and he's wearing some short tartan trousers and a tablecloth. And he's got a cutlass or something. And he's pretending to be a pirate or, a, you know, or something like that, you know, called New Romantics. And the trouble with the English is a lot of them actually just look like bank clerks. So there's a bank clerk wearing a tablecloth. And it was a cartoon at the time by a very bitter old rock and roll cartoonist for the NME called Ray Lowry. And he's got this old teddy boy sitting at the table, and his son, who's a New Romantic, sweeping out of the door dressed in a tablecloth. And he says, 25 years of rock and roll, and he wants to wear the tablecloth. And then he was singing in these big, important voices. They were singing really big stuff, you know, and there was one, I'm sure they were perfectly nice guys from good middle-class homes, but the thing is, they looked silly, and they sounded silly. There's one song, I think it was ABC, and I still do the routine on stage sometimes when I'm doing a spoken word gig, and this guy's singing, his song begins, "When your world is full of strange arrangements," like that, and you're thinking, well, my world used to be, you know, because once a year, well, my parents were still alive. My mum used to take the three of us, the three boys, and we had to go to stay in a seaside town 60 miles away because this really weird old woman from two doors up used to come and give my dad a bath. I thought that was a pretty strange arrangement. I personally wouldn't recommend wearing a tablecloth.
In the 1970s, you were in a glam rock band called Plod.
Yes, I was.
Would it be safe to say that there was a similarly ridiculous outfitting?
Oh, yeah, but that was great. But, you know, people ask me now, they say, you know, were you in a glam rock band? And I say, yeah, man and girl. Yeah, that was actually stupid, yeah. But it was great. It was good fun. And we were considerably younger as well. I mean, the drummer was only 17. I was 19 when I joined that band. In fact, if you go on the Intertent, you'll find a track on there by us. It's called Neo City.
Yeah, I did listen to that. It's quite good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a blazing track. And then, of course, we broke up. In fact, it was, I got an email from the drummer about 2 days ago, on the 13th of January, 1975. 40 years ago, we went into TMC Studios in Tooting and recorded that. And I didn't know that was the date. I knew what year it was. I didn't know exactly what date it was.
Was that a song that you wrote?
Yeah, it was Neo City, yeah, I wrote that. It was me imagining a future, you know, kind of space-age future, you know, because you know, there's a kind of wave of R&B stuff, you know, like the Feel Goods and people like that. that came up in London. There was a feeling that we needed to get back to basics and, you know, play blues and stuff like you get from Howlin' Wolf and, you know, authentic old black American bluesmen, you know? And he said, I didn't want to sing about space aliens and things like that, but I thought, well, I did. I thought there was nothing better to sing about than space aliens and wearing silver suits and putting glitter in my hair. That's what I wanted to do at that point. Mm. So I thought, sod the jeans and greasy hair. I was always kind of defiant like that, really. Mm. I just was a very effeminate youth, really.
Nothing wrong with that.
I preened around. I put lipstick on. I wore makeup. And I generally enjoyed the whole thing. And I didn't want to wear terrible jeans and sing songs about, you know, how life was treating me terribly, because it wasn't actually. It's quite good. I don't know, I'm fairly cheerful about music because I do enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I got no wish to be authentic or rootsy or go for integrity. I love artifice and pretense.
At the same time, you did, in the 80s, write a lot about, like, under wartime conditions and living with Victoria Gray. We're very much about, like, the British identity in the 80s, it seems. Like living under Thatcher,
they were, yeah,
and
well,
miners' strike and
stuff. Things started getting a bit, you know, the holiday was over. What we call the 60s, the party after the war, the holiday was over by the 80s, you know, she smashed all this stuff up. And, you know, she was a grocer's daughter from Grantham in, and she probably meant well, but, you know, I think we're still suffering the fallout from it now. But I don't think it was her, I think... That was the kind of the temperature of the Western world at the time.
Right, with Reagan
there,
as
there
well.
There was Mr. Reagan over your side, remember? And they seem to get on very well. And I don't know how it's going. I don't usually talk politics, actually, because I'm quite ignorant about it a lot of the time. You know, otherwise I just start raving and ranting like my old man. You know, saying they should bring back, I don't know, I don't think they ever had it, did they? You know, executioners. Guys in a medieval hood with a big axe. That's what we need these days. From the politicians.
It does seem like... Even though The Cleaners from Venus has the psychedelic mantle, there's always a social conscience in the songs as well.
It leaks in sometimes, yeah. Especially in the 80s it did.
Mm.
I didn't consciously try and get away from it, but, you know, sometimes a man just gets tired of fighting and arguing, you know, about things. You know, when you wake up in the morning and think, right, what can I protest about this morning, you know? But on the other hand, I don't want to go skipping around pressing flowers all the time.
From 1990's number 13... We'll hear a song later re-recorded for The Greatest Living Englishman, titled A Street Called Prospect.
She's drifting by the place where she pawned her rings, stepping out the way of the skateboard kings. Tomorrow could be sweet, and she's living on a street called Prospect. A girl of many aims, and the beatbox bums, they work in relay teams like a blacksmith customizing noisy boys' dreams. And the old men tap their feet, 'cause they're living on a street called Prospect. And there's a brownstone church with a cracked bell ringing, where the boys learn boxing and the girls learn singing, where the good take the cloth and the fallen join the game before they burn out so briefly like an insect in a flame. The Lone Ranger buys a drink for old St. John. He says it's been some time since the cavalry's gone. Then his voice begins to crack, 'cause they're never coming back to Prospect. And nothing's going on, then the sunlight splinters in a cloud of dust, 'cause it's the devil's flower now, the mill's gone bust. And you don't give up, you see, when the bus goes down the street called Prospect. And reason's never sweet, and ambition isn't choosy, when politeness is a blade and assertion is a Uzi. The poor get angry and the rich make hay, and your youth is like a dog rose, only blossoms for a day. They say they're going mining in the parking lot, it's down to metal and to minerals, but they won't say what. Then they're shaky on their feet when they get back on a street called Prospect. Like burnouts on parade, so love me now and leave me, 'cause I'm going away. I
best not on a streetcar prospect.
You're a published poet. You've been called the most published living English poet.
I am, technically, but that doesn't win any points with the intelligentsia who all live in Oxford and Cambridge. Mm. That's kind of like our Yale and Harvard. Because I'm only most published because I've had a poem in a national newspaper or other every week, or sometimes in multiples, for nearly 25 years now. Since about 1990, I think it began, yeah.
Okay.
I can write tropical poems. And poetry is something that's seen that should have a bit of a mystique, and it shouldn't rhyme, and it should make people sort of sit back and stroke their beards and go, oh, yeah, it's very deep. But I actually write poems that are about things, because I tend to see poetry as being a form of communication. And since it's a short form of communication, well, the brandy in literature's cocktail cabinet, I call it, then it should be readily assimilable. It should be understandable, comprehensible. Mm. If I have myself a glass of brandy, I don't expect to wait till the next day before I've understood that glass of brandy.
Right.
You know, so that it's saying, oh, yes, that was good. I want the thing to work now. And I don't expect it to reward my further persistence other than that I have another glass. I don't see poetry like that. And I think it's been subjected to a rather ungraceful hijack by our top universities, who hunch over it much as a dog would hunch over an old bone that's been much dug up around the garden, you know. Mm. That's how I see poetry, and I've said so. And sometimes when a great, he puts this in inverted commas, great poet is held up before me and said, well, this guy has written this tour de force, which is an indictment of the apocalyptic situation we find ourselves facing, such as I did the other day on the radio, I think, no. This is an emperor who's walking around without any clothes on, and he hasn't even got a very big dick. And I've made myself quite unpopular and unbroadcastable for such things. Mm. So, you know, the BBC no longer ring me up to ask me what I think, and I don't care, you know. I'm doing fine. You know, if you're going to have a Halloween party, have a Halloween party. These arts brigade, they have a Halloween party, and then when a real monster turns up, they all get frightened and don't like it.
Mm.
And I am that real monster. And I will say what I think. And I can actually write the stuff. I can write most of these people off the table. I'm not being arrogant. It's just a statement of fact. I spend all my time writing poetry, right, and writing songs. Most people aren't that muscled up. They just aren't. It's like I'm working out the whole time. But a lot of poets, so-called poets, they're not actually doing a lot of poetry. They're academics. They teach.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they make their money. And then they have the temerity to pontificate, make these great pronouncements about it. Broadcasting media are desperate for it because they're all Philistines and don't actually read poetry. Nobody reads poetry because most of it's ghastly.
Hmm.
It's unreadable, so people have to pretend they know what it is. But in fact, it's actually very simple. What people remember is good rhyming poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we don't have for this, because we'll run out of time soon if we're not careful.
Well, I did want to ask you about recent health setbacks that you've had. Is it true that you died recently?
Yeah, but only briefly.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah, it was May the 20th, 2013. I woke up one morning, sounds like a blues song, but actually a set of occurrences. I knew I was due to go to hospital to have a checkup because I had something wrong with my eye. I was basically losing the sight in one eye. And I wasn't looking forward. I was tired. I'd been doing too much stuff. I'd been helping out an amateur theatre group here. I'd been writing stuff. I hadn't been getting much sleep. I'd probably been drinking wine too successfully. I woke up and I had what is called a non-epileptic seizure. At first, because I recovered from it so quickly and was talking a lot, well, I don't remember what I said, they thought it was a stroke. And then when they took me to the hospital and 3 days of tests, because it did kind of flatten me a bit, they just said, look, this was a non-epileptic brain seizure. We can't, you know, everything was working. My lungs, amazingly, because I smoked for all those years.
Mm.
My heart, everything's good. My blood pressure was maybe the high end of normal, but not too bad. After a nearby doctor, it was something like 150 over 80 or something like that. So that wasn't too savage. It's even lower now. So they couldn't figure this out. But in the end, this very wise neurosurgeon came over and he had a look at me and he started my graphs and he looks and he said, you are a very, very creative person. I said, I thought he must have been reading my press kit or something. He didn't know who I was. you know, he just said how creative I was. They can see this on your brain scan. There's a part of my brain that is probably to do with making up songs and poems. It's incredibly muscled up, which is why I recovered from this thing so quickly, which is what confused them, because I shouldn't have recovered it that quickly. You know, sometimes such a seizure will knock your speech out for a couple of weeks, apparently. He just said to me, basically, sleep more, drink less wine, and remember that you're not now 30, you're actually 60. And it was as simple as that. He said, this is a warning shot across the bows. Within a couple of months of that, I had to have quite some serious eye surgery. It's wiped me out further. But, you know, I've pretty much done what I'm told. I don't drink as much. I do sleep much more than I used to. Because I used to get about 5.5 hours sleep for years, and apparently it's not enough. I suppose it woke me up a bit. It wasn't a bad feeling. My partner didn't like it because she watched the whole thing. She watched me. I was probably out for about, she couldn't calculate, she was panicking, but not much more than a minute, we think. So there was no damage. But it did remind me that the old Reaper's around there rasping at his workbench. But there were still bits where I just don't remember. You know, I'm not old. I don't think I'm old. Except I look in a mirror and see this kind of grey-looking dude there. You know, I don't really feel much different. Sometimes I feel a bit more tired. I've had something to drink the night before. But I do. There are some days where I just think, yeah, let's go and ride a bike or something, you know. Which I do. Well, we better round up soon, because I've got to go and see a young lad's exhibition soon, I think.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today.
Yeah, just what I will say is, look, watch out for this new album. It comes out under my name rather than Venus and Venus. So it'll be Martin Newell, Tea Time Assortment, and it'll be out on Captured Tracks.
Okay.
On the 14th of April, we have slated for it, I think. Special care has gone into the cover and the selection of it. It's a good load of stuff, and a bit, quite a lot of new stuff as well, to the Americans, anyway.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Okay, then. Thanks for talking to me, and stay in touch, and I will speak to you later.
Absolutely. Have a great day.
All right, Charlie. Bye-bye now.
And that's just about all the time we have for this week. I'd like to thank Martin for speaking to Stereo Hysteria. And if you'd like more information about his many creative endeavors, visit martinnewell.co.uk. Be sure to tune in again next week, when our topic will be shadows. But before we go, we'll hear a track from the 1987 Cleaners from Venus album Going to London, called Ilya Kuryakin Looked at Me. This is Charlie, signing off.
But this is Johnny Rhythm just saying good night to you all, and God bless you.
Take her down to London, where she will see Mr.